Hello and welcome back once again to Food Toxicology. I'm Greg Muller, the instructor for the course. Well, today marks perhaps the end, the denouement of the story that we have told in this course, Food Toxicology. What we're going to try to do today is give you a sense of the challenges beyond, the challenges of the future, what scientists in the related fields of food toxicology are working on to create a safer and more nutritious food system. Perhaps the best thing that we can do here as we reflect upon the course and what we have learned is actually review the course. In this particular segment of your education, what we've tried to do is give you a series of lectures in food toxicology. We started off the course giving you an introduction to toxicology, some basic definitions, and then we tried to identify some of the concerns relative to the provision of a safe and nutritious food supply. When we did this, we tried to give you a little bit of a background on risk assessment and the challenges of risk communication. These are issues that are intimately associated with the development of information associated about toxicants in the human food chain. We followed that lecture with a history of U.S. food regulation. What happened in the past century to give us the law that we have, the Food and Drug Administration, the regulations that mitigate food safety concerns in terms of chemical adulteration of food. We introduced the concepts of toxicology, the core concepts, the jargons about poisons and how, in fact, they may impact the human food chain. Some of these toxins can, in fact, be naturally occurring, but some of them as well can be synthetic. The synthetic ones of most concern or major concern were identified in the next lecture, pesticide residues in food. What we did in that lecture, if you recall, is we tried to review the major categories of pesticides that are used in agriculture and as well put it in the context of economic poisons that are also used in public health applications. We tried to go through for the first time in this course the regulatory underpinnings of a specific body of law and regulation associated with food. We followed that lecture with an introductory demonstration of the quantal relationships of dose response. We remembered that Paracelsus gave us his saying, the dose makes the poison. We looked at these relationships and how toxicologists use these dose response relationships to do risk assessment. We then started a biological journey, the journey in terms of absorption of toxicants as these chemicals at the interface of biology have to cross critical membranes or critical pathways in terms of intoxication. We followed that looking at the distribution and storage of toxicants. What are systemic effects? What are localized effects of these intoxications? We talked about how the body has the ability to biotransform and eliminate toxicants. We talked about this in the context of naturally occurring toxicants, the wide variety of secondary chemical compounds, especially plant secondary chemical compounds, that exist that are, in fact, potentially broadly toxic at significant concentrations. How have our bodies evolved to be able to modify the toxicity of these chemical compounds was entertained in terms of an understanding of the biotransformation phase one and phase two and the enhanced potential for elimination of these toxicants from the food supply. We talked about target organ toxicity and how certain chemicals have the ability to target certain cellular processes and biochemical processes to have their overtoxic effects. For example, neurotoxicants affect, in some cases, the concentration of neurotransmitters like cholinesterase inhibitors. This gave us the ability to navigate the different target specificities of particular toxicants. We also did a brief introduction of what happens when toxicants actually change or mess with the molecules of life. We saw this when we examined teratogenesis, mutagenesis, and carcinogenesis as endpoints of considerable concern in terms of the manifestations of toxicology. We then looked at the interaction of food and food components with the immune system in a lecture about food allergy. The new developments in our understanding of the immune system in the past several decades has actually allowed us to understand the concept and management of food allergy as well. We then did a lecture on about food intolerance and metabolic disorders. We saw that, in fact, there are some metabolic disorders that are genetic, and we saw that, in fact, sometimes food intolerance, such as lactose intolerance, can actually be developed at an early age in children. We then reviewed food additives and food additive safety assessment, the processes, the interaction of food additive safety assessment with the Delaney Clause, how we have navigated that, the scope of practice in terms of food additives, and its relationship to reviewing the toxicological profiles of these chemicals that are added to adjust some function, flavor, or chemical basis of food products. We talked about the toxicology of selected food additives and focused in particular on those food additives that have had a lot of concern in terms of regulatory concern or public media attention in the past few decades. We then approached a very significant issue in terms of food safety and food quality in terms of the public arena, and this is the appearance of genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, in food products. We talked about this from some of the ramifications in terms of bioethics, but also some of the social concerns in terms of the development of the new food products and the new crops that, in fact, might be the products of GMO and biotech processing. We talked about some of the concerns in terms of the development of allergies and food allergies and the development of potentials for other toxic responses in terms of changing some of the protein levels, changing some of the secondary chemical compounds in some of the plant systems modified by biotechnology. We then did a lecture where we explored food irradiation or cold pasteurization. We tried to give you a little bit of the physical background of the interaction of ionizing radiation. Ionizing radiation with the intent to minimize or destroy spoilage bacteria and pathogenic bacteria. We then did a lecture exploring the ecological biochemistry of food, this so-called food ecology. How have we essentially grown up with our environment and learning what foods to eat and what foods perhaps are poisonous, those plants and fungi that contain natural toxins. We actually followed this with another category of natural toxins. These are toxic mold and the development of mycotoxins. What are some of the concerns in terms of managing mycotoxins in the human food supply? We then explored marine toxins in food. This is often quite colorful, but this is a dangerous area of food. There is lethality associated with marine toxins in food. Quite often these are neurotoxicological and therefore can be potentially crippling in acute exposure, but also have chronic and long-term effects in terms of nervous system, central nervous system function. We then explored some naturally occurring toxicants and their relationship, their causation relationship to foodborne disease. Some of these have to do with staples in developing countries, processed foods that need to be, foods that need to be processed in terms of minimizing their naturally occurring toxicants, sometimes by a food processing technique such as cooking. We explored bacterial pathogenesis from the approach of the chemicals, typically proteins, but sometimes lipopolysaccharides that are associated with bacterial infestations. We saw that we have great concern in terms of survivability of these compounds, particularly endotoxins, in food cooking processes. We may destroy the organism, but we often do not destroy the chemical that the organism produces on its route to pathogenesis. We talked about an issue of increasing concern, and this is animal drug residues in food, the relationship of the regulatory apparatus and veterinary medical practice in terms of animal health, maintenance and the provision of animal food products, not only here in the U.S., but internationally. Some of the concerns, and we focused on the primary concern that most scientists that analyze this situation have, and this is with the development of antibiotic resistance from subclinical, primarily subclinical, dosing of food animals with antibiotics. We talked about then some toxicants that are formed during food processing. We tried to review the top dozen or so toxicants that have, I guess, the majority concern in terms of the past few decades of research in this area. We then did a focus case study on dioxin and related compounds, these lipophilic compounds that have a specific pathway of chlorinated hydrocarbon toxicity, and how they have the ability to, because of their lipophilic nature, to reside and enter the human food chain and stay there for quite a long time. We then did a risk assessment of lead and arsenic in the human food chain, and then we followed that with mercury in the human food chain, and talked about methylmercury, and in fact how methylmercury, a neurotoxin of considerable stature, has been studied in terms of the diets of individuals that eat large quantities of seafood. Well, this course of study, I think, has prepared you well in terms of your understanding of food toxicology and its relationship to human health, its relationship to the provision of a safe and nutritious food supply. There are some things, though, that are developing beyond what the scope of this particular course, things that appear in the present as a part of the frontier of food toxicology. These frontiers include the expanded use of integrated effects, these response spectra, rather than looking at a single toxic effect in terms of risk assessment. We always default to lethality, but sometimes it can be an undesirable clinical endpoint. We have been challenged just developing the basis of toxicological review of chemical compounds on a single effect basis. But perhaps the frontier is coming up with methods and modes of integrating these effects, gathering these responses into syndromes, into response spectrum. We'll need some new approaches as well on the frontier for the examination of the contributions of mixtures of chemicals. We know pretty well in terms of foods that enter the human food chain, the regulated food chain, the actions and activities of single chemicals. We are only now coming up with the generalized approaches to look at additive or synergistic effects of toxicants, as well as those that provide for antagonism effects that counter perhaps toxication reactions of other chemicals, but also the reactions of other chemicals for nutritional gain. We'll need to become better at this so we can kind of analyze some of the natural flavor complexes that we are increasingly using in food science. We'll need to, in the future as well, develop new biomarkers of intoxication. Quite often what we find is that the simple animal studies don't give us sufficient information to come up with a credible risk assessment profile for a particular chemical or process. What we need to do, for example, and dioxins have been one of the areas where we've had to actually delve into molecular biology and biochemistry at a very finite level to understand the cellular and molecular relationships of intoxication. We need to develop some new biomarkers so that we can have an assessment of toxicology that is subclinical. We'll need as well to develop some surrogate animal models, rat studies, the backbone, if you will, of human health risk assessment for many decades have been a very strong tool in risk assessment and comparative toxicology. But perhaps because of the life cycle of rats and some of the challenges in using that particular species, there are perhaps opportunities to develop these surrogate animal models with lower organisms that have shorter life cycles. These shorter life cycles allow us to look, for instance, at second and tertiary generation effects, for example, in amphibian models, looking at teratogenesis from particular intoxications. The frontier of food toxicology also will incorporate in silico approaches. In silico is a new term for computer modeling, where we do a wonderful database manipulation and modeling of not only organisms, but quantitative structure, activity, relationships of chemicals and particular receptors. As we become smarter, as our models become more robust, we will have in the future direct extrapolations of what is an exciting field today in computer modeling of toxicology. We can use these models in robust fashions for iterative and systems types approaches that allow for an introduction of biological complexity, perhaps that is overly costly and difficult to do in terms of real life laboratory experiments. What this will help us do, for example, in food additive and drug development, preservative development, is to develop safer approaches to modifying our personal health and food quality. In the future, we'll see more of toxicogenomics, where we have DNA and RNA targets of toxins, understanding receptors and the development of DNA, RNA targets of intoxication. As well, we'll see an increased use of toxicoproteomics, where, in fact, as we have developed an understanding of toxicology, many of the targets of intoxication end up being proteins. These proteins have dramatic impacts if, for example, they are hormones, receptors, or enzymes. We'll see the development of an emerging field. This is toxicometabolomics. This has to do with the dynamic multi-parameter metabolic responses, looking, for example, at total metabolism or defined metabolic syndromes and how they might change in intoxication. We'll see new techniques, NMR, we'll see mass spectrometric, as well as imaging techniques that are used to examine metabolic responses, generalized and subclinical metabolic responses to intoxication. We'll also see in the frontier an increased understanding of the molecular biology of various cellular processes, such as apoptosis. Apoptosis is the chemical stimulation of programmed cell death. Obviously, if we have a chemical that initiates that stimulation process, that cytokine stimulation, we have the ability to have this chain of events that leads to cellular damage, cellular injury, that has to do with a different sort of relationship than perhaps we have studied in past examinations of molecular toxicology. One of the big changes that perhaps is occurring and is on the immediate frontier is the transition from the way we have done the quantitative relationship of dose and response, the development of no observed adverse effect levels, the lowest observed adverse effect levels, and transitioning to something referred to as a benchmark dose. Remember that in our approach that we have learned here in food toxicology, we have taken these NOELs and LOELs that we have developed primarily from animal studies, and we multiply those by various uncertainty factors, such as the comparative toxicology factor, the fact that we are not rats, and all of the other uncertainty factors about trying to quantify what we know, and more importantly, what we don't know about a potential for intoxication, to come up with a reference dose that is used in managing human health. We can do that same sort of process in a different way with something referred to as the benchmark dose. Now, this benchmark dose is perhaps a little bit of a new concept for students in an introductory course in toxicology. It is an alternative to these NOEL and LOEL approaches that we've talked about as that are the backbone of dose response assessment in toxicology. There are scientists that think that BMDs, or benchmark doses, are a more quantitative way of driving some of these regulatory levels for various health effects that are assumed to have a nonlinear or a threshold-like low-dose response relationship. And remember that we have determined that the NOELs and the LOELs in traditional dose response analysis on a sigmoidal curve are in fact discrete study doses. These are, in fact, the lowest dose in an animal trial that actually did not or did actually develop an observed effect. When we use a benchmark dose, we release ourselves from actually having to have data at that particular level. And as you'll see, these BMDs, or benchmark doses, actually allow us to model the dose response curve in the range of the observable data. And so there is a bit of statistical interpolation allowed in benchmark dose approach versus the traditional dose response. This interpolation allows for an estimate of the dose that corresponds to a particular level of response. And so what we have is an agreement of this BMR, benchmark response, that we have concluded is a significant response. This helps us as we start approaching, for example, subclinical effects. Maybe cellular metabolism changes might be identified as a particular BMR, benchmark response, for the initial stages, the preclinical stages of intoxication. With those benchmark doses, we can also establish confidence limits, the BMDL, the lower confidence limit of the benchmark dose, in the same way in terms of establishing a window of uncertainty on the determination of a BMD. Now, the BMD approach can be used in the same way as we have done traditional dose response modeling. We can use it for all types of chemical and physical agents and associated endpoints. This can be done regardless of the assumptions about low-dose linearity or non-linearity during this approach, and this has to do with examining, for example, background responses at zero dose. This modeling is done in the observable range, and so we're not extrapolating out of the area of actual data. And typically, it's related to a response rate near the lower end of this observable dose range. And so this is good because quite often if we're looking for cellular impacts, for example, receptor activations, background animals that are not dosed will have a certain degree of receptor activation, for example. We can look at benchmark doses as any change to that background level. For example, in computing a benchmark dose, we're going to first need to select a benchmark response or a group of responses. This can be collected in terms of a syndrome or a collection of potential identifiable endpoints. We then will take and do a traditional dose response study where we calculate the dose and we put that, graph that against a particular response and we fit the data to that. There are other alternative fittings. We approach this from a statistical point of view of looking at a model, a best fit significantly, statistically significant and robust model for this particular type of data. We then adopt a confidence limit for that particular benchmark dose assessment. We can use an example of vinclozolin, which is a fungicide. It's a general purpose fungicide. It's a spore inhibitor. It's used in many crops in agriculture. It has had great concern in recent history in terms of regulatory review because of its potential as an endocrine disruptor. So we'll want to take a look at this particular compound as an example, as a hormonally active substance in human health risk assessment. We know that this particular fungicide is an anti-androgen. It's an anti-agonist for this, so this is an estrogenic type compound. It has the potential to produce adverse effects when it's administered during sexual differentiation in the fetus or around the time of puberty in the rat model. It can alter the sexual functions and fitness in adult male rats. So in a particular study that we'll review here, we'll examine the exposure to this fungicide, vinclozolin, around the puberty in terms of male reproductive tract and serum hormone levels. This study, this rat study, was calculated, doses were calculated for age in terms of the endpoints, in terms of the benchmark doses. for about six different endpoints. They included prepucial separation. This is separation of the prepuce from the gland's penis in terms of sexual maturation of the penis. This is also for epididymal weight, seminal vesicle weight, ventral prostate weight, and serum concentrations of testosterone and luteinizing hormone. Many of you have heard of luteinizing hormone. Luteinizing hormone is the hormone that is used in adult human female pregnancy tests. These am I pregnant or not urine tests that are sold in drugstores are actually luteinizing hormone detectors. Now, this hormone is synthesized and secreted by the pituitary gland. In the female, a surge in luteinizing hormone actually triggers ovulation. This is also a hormone that is found in males. It does have an impact to stimulate the production of testosterone. It's more important, and especially high levels of luteinizing hormone are associated with metabolic dysfunction in males. Now, if we take a look at the data from this example study, this is a graph of the mean serum luteinizing hormone in nanograms per milliliter on this graph. And so here's the dose from 0 to 100 nanograms per milliliter. And so this is one of the six endpoints in this particular endocrine disruption study. And this is the mean response in terms of the concentration. This is the dose of the fungicide. This is the concentration of the luteinizing hormone. You can see that here's a background. This is the control here, here at this particular data point. And as the dose is increased, you see that there is a response in terms of increase of serum LH. This dose response curve, which is called a Hill model, it's a statistical model for this type of data. You can see fairly wide confidence limits in terms of this, and this is the best fit for this. This is a blow up of the important part, the benchmark dose part of the curve. And what we're going to do in this particular example is develop a benchmark dose that is essentially expressed as the a response that is increased from the change of the standard deviation equal to the standard deviation of the control group. So if the control group has a certain standard deviation, an increase in that standard deviation in that from that level by an equivalent standard deviation is regarded under this particular definition as the benchmark dose. What you see here is, in fact, that this benchmark dose, and as well the lowest level uncertainty of that dose, but the BMD is significantly below what would be regarded as the lowest observed adverse effect level. And so there is an enhanced ability of benchmark doses to provide increased protection in terms of toxicological assessment. If we take a look at the benchmark doses for all six endpoints in this particular study, you can see that the luteinizing hormone here appears at very low doses. And so this is, in terms of the pathway, this is a signaling hormone that actually increases. It's a very sensitive benchmark relative to serum testosterone. Serum testosterone levels are actually triggered by luteinizing hormone. And the other physiological factors in terms of development of the testes, development of the penis in this rat model study are actually clustered somewhat together up here in the dose range between, especially when you regard these uncertainty limits here, they're somewhat clustered together and within each other. Certainty, the outlier, if you will, in terms of the most sensitive aspect of endpoints is in fact this luteinizing hormone. This gives you an idea that the changes in this hormone level over background at extraordinary low doses can be used in a risk assessment process. Now, in terms of continuing some of the frontiers of food toxicology, we'll have to have an increased understanding of the non-human antimicrobial usage and its impact on antimicrobial resistance. Bad bugs that will decrease the efficacy of the various antimicrobial drugs that we have to combat human pathogenesis. We'll need increased methods and better methods at safety evaluation of genetically modified foods. There are some concerns that we are changing things perhaps that we are not looking for in terms of our assays. We need to identify those on a relative risk basis and a comparison in terms of risk versus benefits. If in fact we are going to enhance the quality of the food system, enhance the quantity of food available to developing nations, we need to be able to do this in a logical, reasoned way in terms of monitoring the costs versus those potential benefits. Those costs are in enhanced safety or decreased safety of the food product. We'll have to look, for example, at new approaches to GM foods, where in fact we are looking not at trans-species genetics, like putting fish proteins in potatoes, but perhaps looking at intra-species transgenics, where we take the biotech attributes, the genetic attributes of one of the members of that species and translate it into another member to enhance, for example, its growth in certain types of environmental conditions or its resistance to insect infestation, or for instance in its development in the regards to the potato of the development of things like acrylamide because of levels of naturally occurring products in the potato during the cooking process. We'll need as well to look at new approaches to modeling and understanding low-level exposure approaches. We identified some of this, the challenges of these in looking at the neurotoxic effects of methylmercury and also the toxic impacts and estrogenic effects of low-level dioxin exposure. In terms of human health and risk assessment, we'll have to have an increased understanding of the biotoxins in shellfish. We need to identify some of the maximum levels of some of the compounds that are relatively newly discovered in the past 5 years or so. Look at newer and more efficient analytical methods. Have a better understanding of the geographic distribution of concern of these toxins, and as well some of their biotoxin forming phytoplankton and the response to human action and activity such as pollution and wastewater discharge to the development of these biotoxin forming marine phytoplankton. We'll have to enhance and increase the ability of mycotoxin prevention and control, and this is pretty much by understanding the dynamics of mycotoxin growth and development in certain types of food preservation and food processing processes. We'll need as well to enhance our understanding and utilization of probabilistic risk assessment in food allergies so that we can enhance not only the safety of the food, but enhance our understanding of the uncertainties associated with food allergy. A part of the background for this has been enabled by our enhanced immune system knowledge that perhaps in the past 15 years, with the advent of disease syndromes that challenge the immune system, we now have an increased understanding of the immune system through research, using that new knowledge to develop new approaches to risk assessment for food allergy. Well, when we started this course, we had some course goals for students that were enrolled. I wanted to provide you with a broad foundation of knowledge about the sources, pathways, receptors, and controls of toxicants in the human food chain. I wanted to help assist you in achieving a high level of understanding and some interpretive capacity in food toxicology. I wanted you as well to help develop your critical thinking skills about risks, risk communication, risk assessments associated with foodborne toxicants. This is a challenge in terms of coming up with a sufficient curriculum for all levels and types of students in terms of students' preparations and backgrounds. We hope that you have achieved what you came to this goal and this course for in terms of your own personal goals. I think we all have to reflect that education is about changing the world. And in my context, it's about changing the world one student at a time. I hope that this course has, in fact, changed your world. I wish for you that this journey in your academic career has been somewhat stimulated and fulfilled by taking this course, that you, in fact, have taken one step closer to becoming those reliable strangers that we talked about in the introductory aspects of this course on the journey to a safe and nutritious food supply. With that, I thank you for your attendance in this course. It's been a joy to teach it. I welcome your continued communication with me. Call me anytime. Enjoy the rest of the course in terms of the final submissions of the final exam and the final course papers. Until the time we meet again, good luck to you all. Thank you very much.